One more time for those of you at the back. This is Soft Revolution, the podcast. How you doing, everybody? Thank you for joining us for another week. My name is Torquil Campbell.
I'm Ali Moman.
And this week on the pod, we have an actor, a writer, a director of cinema, whose name is Dara Campbell. Dara has just released a film in which she stars called Anne at 13,000 Feet. It's an extraordinary film. It's really, really spooky and unnerving and strange and not quite like anything I've ever seen before. And as I said, Dara is a writer and a director. She's made collaborations with a filmmaker called Sophia Bodanowitz. She made this film Never Eat Alone that did extremely well. She's been screened all over the world. She's in another film by Kazik Radwanski, who directed Anne at 13,000 Feet, called How Heavy This Hammer. And she is a part of a way of making films that some people have derisively called mumblecore. Everything has to have a fucking BuzzFeed name now, Ali. You can't do anything without some cutie pie from, you know, Fordham University coming up with a catchphrase. Anyway, she's an extraordinary artist. She has done all this. And Anne at 13,000 Feet, by the way, just won the Toronto Film Critics Association Best Film Award. $100,000 prize. I don't usually talk about prizes, but 100 grand, that makes a prize worth talking about.
Yeah.
Dara has done all of this, Ali. The most extraordinary thing about her is she's done it all, achieved all of this, while being a member of my family. That's not an easy thing. Dara is my beloved niece, but she's also an incredible artist, and she's part of a group of people who are making art on micro budgets, completely without any kind of structure around them other than the ones they make for themselves. And that's why I thought it would be so cool to have her on Soft Revolution to talk about her amazing new film, Anne at 13,000 Feet. Before we get to Dara, though, and we are really excited to talk to her, I don't know if you've seen this film, Ali, but it's really, you know, I kind of put off watching it, frankly, because I don't think I'm going to spoil anything by saying that part of the film is that Dara's character, Anne, becomes obsessed with skydiving. And so Dara skydived. I'm going to ask her about this later.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to express. I've known Dara obviously since the moment she came into existence and loved her all those days. But if you wanted me to make a list of 700 people that I knew that might skydive potentially, she would not even be on the long list of that short list of 700 people. This is not a skydiving type. You understand what I'm saying? She's quite bookish. She's a city gal. She's sophisticated. But she jumped out of a plane 13 times. The things we do for art. Okay, that's coming up later on the pod. First, the never-ending shitstorm that constitutes modern life, which we call the news. Ali, before we get to that, I wanted to mention, and I'm sure you've marked this as well, it's March 12th today. Yesterday, a year ago, I got on a plane with my daughter and flew to Niagara-on-the-Lake for quote-unquote March break, which I knew at the time was going to be more like year break, so I packed for 3 months. And we got to Niagara, and sure enough, the world shut down. I think March 11th was actually the day that the WHO declared a global pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
A few days later, the Shaw Festival, where my wife was working, closed, and then I lost all my gigs. Your show closed. And right around this time, in this week, you and I decided to start talking to each other and recording it. And so it's been a year for us as well, which is kind of crazy that our journey on this podcast will forever be linked to the beginning of this terrible, terrible situation.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I look back and I'm like, what the hell would I have done if I hadn't been able to talk to Ali each week? And if I hadn't felt like I was being given the opportunity to interview and chat with, you know, doctors and artists and intellectuals and all the different people that we've had on this show over the last year and all their perspectives on how to survive in this. And I just feel incredibly lucky that we bothered to do this, you know, and sort of at a loss as to what my sense of identity would be like if we hadn't, because I have been making art on my own, but I haven't been effectively doing what I did for a living for all of my life, for the longest period in my life. And so this has really been not just a way of, you know, working through the pandemic in my mind and in my heart, but sort of you know, doing what we set out to do, which was give ourselves a little bit of a side hustle and something that also allowed us to speak and allowed us to express ourselves and make something we thought was great. So thank you, buddy, for
thank you.
Doing it with me. I really appreciate it.
When you
look back over this year, you have gone so far. You started out doing 8 shows a week in Come From Away, and now you're running for the Liberal nomination. I mean, it's a crazy journey. Do you think, like, what are you going to do differently forever from this moment forward in the beginning of this second year?
For me, it's realizing that, you know, we are the flap of a butterfly can cause a tsunami, and we are all butterflies. Meaning that that's what this pandemic has really taught. And so it's being cognizant of my and everyone around me, their power. Because we are far more powerful than we think. The flap of a butterfly can cause a tsunami, and we are all butterflies. 100%.
And does that mean, like, does that leave you with a residual, maybe everlasting anxiety about the consequences of the things you do in the world? That's something that's occurred to me recently, is like, you're absolutely right. I am 100% more aware of my own actions and of other people's, you know, the tiniest little things, like, you know, do you give somebody 6 feet when you walk past them, right? Like, all these tiny signals we send to each other that we care for each other, that we give a damn about each other's comfort and safety, have become a part of the conversation, the silent conversation that goes on between human beings out on the street and in places of business everywhere all day. Do you feel like that's going to give us a more anxious society? Or will we just, like, once there's 90% herd immunity and there's no deaths for a week in Canada, are we just going to be like, fuck it, let's make out? What's your thought about that?
Well, making out is fun. So let there be a little bit of making out with consent and joy and love. I am for that.
Yeah, be good.
No, I really think people, I hope, will realize just how connected we are. The notion of individualism is a very lovely thing, but in a world that is as interconnected as we are, it has to be individualism plus, or we have to accept collectivism. That we just simply have to collect it. I really do think that, you know, after the Spanish flu, 1918, it was the roaring 20s. I do hope that, you know, our future, our economic recovery or our soul recovery, whatever, feels and looks like a giant block party. That is my hope. And I want people to go into their communities. I want people to know their neighbor. I feel like we've like really gotten apart from each other. And this pandemic has taught us that you cannot be apart from each other.
Well, that is a hopeful
thing. You just can't
go
away, because, you know, we also think about, you know, the echo chambers. We speak about it all the time, social media. You think that you can go away into your own little corner, but you lose the awareness that there's another little corner that's percolating, and that little corner is going to storm the Capitol. So it's just really important, I think, for us to be able to, like, step back and view the holistic picture of kind of who we are and what we are and where we're going.
Research is actually showing that people have gotten to know their neighbors more during this, which I think
that's exceptional,
fascinating, and great. You know, one of the weird things moving forward for me is, for the first time, like, you know, I have free floating anxiety. You give me, you know, an oasis in the middle of a desert with a 5-star luxury hotel next to it and a pile of cash and everyone I love, I'll find something to feel anxious about. But I did get my first kind of shot of anxiety this week about going back to what I did. I was having calls about, well, because I have, you know, you search for identity through something like this, right? Like, I think the first 6 or 7 months of this experience was really, like, for me personally, speaking personally, because I lost my job and the routine of my life was so changed, I was thinking a lot to myself, God, I had no idea how much my identity was wrapped up in what I do for a living. Who am I without that? Who am I without that behavior? And now I have sort of found an identity which is much more involved and wrapped up in my family life, my daily quotidian obligations, the miniaturism of my life, right? Like that is much more what I'm focused on and has become a part of my identity. And the thought of going back out into the big wide world and getting out on stage and drumming up all that energy and being responsible for showing up at airports and all that stuff, which, yeah, it was stressing me. It was a stressful life I was living. And there is no choice but to go back to it in some ways because it's how I make a living and I love what I do.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's fun.
It is awesome and fun. But I think that it's a strange... I read the other day somewhere a person saying, we all went into this together, but we're all going to come out of it alone, differently. Everybody's escape route out of this thing is different. There's a different garden path. And I actually think that will be a lonelier time in some ways for people than this time during which we all thought, well, life is shit, but it's shit in the same way for everyone.
Oh,
and we're
no,
now
I
going
disagree.
Back to that fractured place.
No, that's very poetic and beautiful. And I could see the art.
It's bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah.
I find myself in that situation, Allie. That's the rhetorical road I like to stroll down every once in a while.
People are going to get back and people are going to crave each other and people are going to want to connect with each other. Oh my God, like I get tingles thinking about it. I get tingles thinking about it.
Oh, absolutely. I don't disagree with you at all about that. What I mean is in a search for a return to whatever normal is now, in a search for the return to our lives, so to speak.
Yeah.
That road is complicated by everything that has happened to people over the last year, whether you've lost a loved one, whether you've gone broke, whether you've ended a relationship or whether you've started one, whether this year has been surprisingly good for you. I mean, in a lot of ways for you, this has been an amazing moment where you were able to switch streams and start doing something that you've always thought about doing, but your success in something else was keeping you from doing so. You know, I'm just saying that I think there is going to be a lot of individual questioning amongst ourselves about what we're going back to and how we want it to
true.
Be.
Yeah,
and,
that's true.
And to that end, let me get to a little piece of, I guess, what you would call news, which is, you know, stuff's opening up again. Shows are starting to be booked again in the States. Texas is open at 100% capacity. I mean, these cowboys are crazy, but... So now we're going to see people going back into public spaces in the coming months. Can we please? I am begging you all out there in the artistic community. You don't have a lot of money to spend on wet wipes. Can we avoid ridiculous pandemic hygiene theater? It has been scientifically proven that this thing is spread by aerosols and droplets in the air. It's in the air, folks. It is extremely difficult to get this thing by touching surfaces and then touching your face. We are about to see artistic and cultural institutions putting on a completely unnecessary, expensive, time-wasting, environment-damaging series of displays about how clean they are. And about how clean we all have to be when we're together. It's really, really not backed up by science. And we have a chance to get this right. We have a chance to get it right in the theater and the opera and the ballet and rock and roll clubs. Great. Have hand sanitizer around. Absolutely. Make it ubiquitous. Great. Make sure that people have, you know, if you need to get a vaccine card, I am not necessarily against that idea. But the notion that we're going to be sprayed with disinfectant when we walk through doors, or that you won't be able to use a cup more than once, or there can't be anything that your programs have to be digitally downloaded. Can we not? It's just ridiculous. And it's
one of
those
things.
Well,
that's good for the environment. That one thing is good.
Well, that is good for the environment. But you know, what I'm saying is you go to the airport
right now. And
it could
be an NFT. It could be an NFT. You could sell it for $5 million. So there you go. This is amazing.
That's not good for the environment.
Oh, yeah, right.
But you know, you go to the airport now and you have this absurdity where you have a bottle of water. You go through security. The person takes the bottle of water from you ostensibly because it contains, I don't know, nitrous oxide or a deadly gas that you're going to release when you get on this airplane. And they throw it in the garbage bin next to them. If it's a deadly gas, if it's an explosive, why are they throwing it in a garbage can next to them? The answer is it's theater. It's bullshit. It's not making anyone safer. It's wasting plastic. It's wasting water. It's making you spend more money. Taking your shoes off doesn't prevent people from blowing up airplanes. It's ridiculous. And it's been 20 years of that nonsense.
But how does it make people feel? That's the most important thing. At the end of the day, the artistic director is going to do whatever they need to do so that people feel safe.
Okay, but Ali, we have so often argued against this kind of public policy on this
show. Yeah, I'm just saying that's why they're going to do it.
But we don't need to treat people like five-year-old children.
But is it our job or is it the job of the CDC in America or is it the job of Health Canada here? The CDC was really great. I think, you know, Alan Dutsky was here a few weeks ago and he was saying, you know, the new leadership at CDC is amazing and I feel really good about it. And you know what? We are reaping the benefits of that. Because I unfortunately forget her name right now, but you know, their guidance on vaccination, which happened last week, was euphoric to me because they basically said that if you are vaccinated, you've received your final dose and 2 weeks have passed. If you are with somebody who else has gone through that, you do not need to mask or socially distance indoors. They also said if you've done that and somebody else is there who hasn't been vaccinated, you do not need to mask or socially distance. You are whatever. Yeah. And so we need to get that from the top down.
That's great. But the truth of the matter is there's actually a lot of epidemiologists out there. It was Zeynep Tufekci and Monica Gandhi included, people we respect a lot.
Well, she's not an epidemiologist, but
no, the world's best amateur epidemiologist, according to the New York Times. Anyway, there's lots of people out there who are arguing that the CDC guidelines are too cautious. Now, I would argue that that's the role of a medical organization, is to be overly cautious and to make public health announcements based on absolutely strict science. But you know what? The CDC also recommends that pregnant women not have eggs. You know, the CDC recommends all kinds of things that society ignores because it's overly cautious and it's ridiculously punitive against people's ability to live a normal life.
This CDC has shown that they will change their opinion. So they've recently also changed.
Absolutely, but what I'm saying is the CDC is not going to come in and bully you as a theater operator into doing this kind of thing. You're going to do it, and I get it. You want to demonstrate to your customers that you're being extremely cautious. But I would say you're going to save a lot of time and money and pain and inconvenience and annoyed customers if instead, right off the bat, you say, here's what we're doing and here's what we're not doing and this is why. You don't need to worry about this in our place of business. You don't need to worry about your coat check. You're not going to get coronavirus from somebody checking your coat. So like all that kind of stuff is an argument we're going to have to make as an industry. And I hope instead of doing the classic modern day thing, which is virtue signaling your way into a dead end from which you can never escape, we actually take the time to treat our customers like grownups, talk to them with respect, a little nuance, and explain to them what's going to be different and what's going to be the same. What's going to go back to the way it was? We don't need to just use plastic cups. You can rewash glasses in nightclubs.
Or spend the money on ventilation. Derek Thompson at The Atlantic had an article, and he's been really, really great on this stuff. And he talks about, you know, he says, enough with the hygiene theater, open windows. Starting March 18th at Crow's Theater, New Societies, a strategy game combining the fun of board games with a live theatrical narrative. Compete with other teams to build an ideal society, but be careful. The choices you make shape the game. Play by yourself in a pair or with the whole fam. You can even team up to play with friends and other households. Less than 100 tickets remain. Crow's Theater presents New Societies from Recurrent Theater, March 18th to the 28th. Tickets at crowstheater.com.
Let's move on to the culture wars, because they rage. They rage, Ali. In fact, sometimes I think that the internet was only invented so that people could argue about dumb pop culture shit get any work done.
Sounds like fun.
Were you a Dr. Seuss person when you were a kid?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Sure. Who wasn't? You had it forced down your throat. I mean, it was nobody gave you
them.
Nabokov.
The big
not
ones,
all of
the
them.
Important ones. Yeah. Yeah. Nobody right. was
the
like,
major,
here, yeah, here's a master
major canon.
And Margarita. Yeah.
Nobody
yeah.
gave you the master and Margarita. I wish they had. But obviously, I'm sure if you haven't been living under a rock, and maybe some of you have by choice over the last week, you will have heard that Dr. Seuss has been in the news recently because five of his titles lesser known titles, not the Green Eggs and Ham, not the big hit, the heavy hitters, but five of his titles were decided upon to have racist imagery or references in their text. And the estate of Dr. Seuss decided to pull these books from print. There has been, of course, outcry on either end. There's been people saying that's a good thing. There's been people saying that's a bad thing. Ali, where do you come down on this kind of idea? Is there any place for getting rid of books in the world?
These books, specifically and particularly, I think, yeah, sure, why not? The reason why I say this is I want to talk about this idea later in respect to Joe Biden's speech that he made last night. But there is something that happens in humans, and it happens with your parents. It's a psychotherapy term. It's called parental differentiation, in which you realize that you are not your parents. And you realize that your parents aren't as amazing as you thought they were. And you realize that while you are following in their footsteps, you are wearing your own shoes and you have your own compass. And my thing that I really hope that we can do one day is that we can embark on something called historical differentiation, in which we go back into the past and we start to realize that all these people whom we venerated before, they are not indeed perfect. And, you know, saying good things about them doesn't, you know, negate the bad things. And that we're able to like have a holistic view, to have two thoughts in our head at once in respect to this. Do I think those books and those characters that are in those books are bad and should not be taught to kids? Yeah, 100%. Does the estate of Dr. Seuss have the right to take them out? Yeah, 100%. Does an organization, even if Dr. Seuss's estate didn't want to do it, have the right and ability to say, we do not want to sell this? 100% they can. So I go to myself, in a perfect world, I would love to be in a situation where everyone can look at those five books and understand the racism and the context and all that stuff. I really love it. For instance, Disney Plus, when you want to watch Gone with the Wind, there's an explainer. There's
or the Muppets.
Or the Muppets. It's all there. But also, you know, if we can't, we can't. I don't know. Well, I kind of think, get them out. Why not?
I've been thinking a lot about it because I have to say that it ultimately for me comes down to the classic argument that somebody from the ACLU would make, right? The American Civil Liberties Union, which is that if you don't protect the right of work to be published that is offensive to you, then that can be used against you. That if you
but
use
it's not
a stick
the government.
Hang on. In this case, there's absolutely no reason, as you say, why the estate of Dr. Seuss shouldn't, as a business, decide that these books don't represent their point of view or what they want to put into the world and remove them. So in a way, it's a tempest in a teapot. But on a broader level, I do think it's a missed opportunity. And I do think that Disney Plus did the smarter thing. And it
the harder thing, the harder thing.
The harder thing and the smarter thing. And it reminds me a lot of an interview I heard with Zadie Smith, the wonderful novelist and essayist.
Yeah, you bring this
England,
up a lot. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who talked about Pride and Prejudice and her daughter reading Pride and Prejudice and her saying to her daughter, going through Pride and Prejudice and discussing with her daughter how Mr. Darcy might have gotten so rich, right? And that discussion inevitably leads to slavery. And so instead of saying to her daughter, you can't read this book, you mustn't read this book because it affirms a system and it lets people off the hook who were doing terrible things and it poses them as romantic idols and that's not how we should be living in the world. Instead, complete history. Talk to the child, talk to yourself, have a conversation with the book about the way in which the world has changed since this book was written and the way in which the world has not changed since this book was written. And so to me, ultimately, it's a missed opportunity to say to kids in this particular case, you're going to see some stuff in this book that is not right, that's weird. Now, that's a strange lesson to teach to kids, but that's what Dr. Seuss was all about, was teaching tough lessons. There's a lot of tough lessons buried inside the fun, playful rhyme of Dr. Seuss books. There's lessons about death and about jealousy and about personal ambition and about prejudice and about all kinds of things. He was deepening the conversation for children. And so for me, it just feels like a missed opportunity to because we can't escape our past.
But we don't
have
the
reconcile
system.
With it. What do you mean by that?
We don't have the I'm going to bring up the Joe Biden thing. Yesterday what I saw was I saw somebody trying to do the FDR
You're talking
fireside
about
chat.
Joe Biden's
his address
speech
to the nation,
yesterday.
Yeah. He right, got up okay. there, it was 20 minutes. He's like every day and he pulls out a card about the people that he has a number of like how many deaths a day. He's talking to the people. It's like long, it's detailed, it's nuanced. He's trying to do what FDR did. Right. He's trying to do what FDR did. And the reason I want to bring up the historical differentiation is like I want everyone to be aware that I'm cognizant of all the things that FDR also did that was bad. I know about the internment camps. Do not at me. I know everything. But I have had the
Go ahead, Adam.
Well, if I get some followers, go ahead at me. You know, I want it. It's good for my analytics. But the my kind of point is, you know, we need to, in this environment of social media and Twitter that is limited by 280 characters, on Facebook and Instagram that is limited by an algorithm, so the more engaging, the more kind of enraging something is that it propagates. Yeah, this is why a podcast is really great, and I think this is why people really enjoy podcasts. But we just do not have, unfortunately, a system to be able to sit down and be able to discuss nuance in a way that an entire society could. So what you're saying is great.
Not only
do we
have a system which absolutely categorically tries to erase nuance, right?
Yeah.
Like whose very technical structure is based upon a lack of nuance, is based upon the binary. So our conversations, the medium does become the message. The conversations all twist around the system which platform these conversations, and that has no room for nuance. So here we are, canceling Dr. Seuss or not canceling right-wing people buying hundreds of millions of copies of Dr. Seuss thinking
like,
they're owning the libs.
I know. In a perfect world, we would be able to sit down with a child to, yes, Green Eggs and Ham, and also I want to bring up this other title, and I want to teach you as well why this is wrong and why this character is racist and why this character denotes. Like, that would be the most idyllic society. Like, right now, it's like the Republic right now, you and I. We're like Plato and Aristotle just having big conversations about what the beautiful world can look like. But yeah, that would be the ideal thing. But unfortunately, the way kids are taught, the screens in front of them, and the way social media works, we cannot have these conversations. And when we have these conversations, unfortunately, they aren't in the collective consciousness. They are in, you know, podcasts with thousands of listeners here or in private conversations. And the reason why I appreciated what Biden was doing is I could tell he's trying. At least he's trying. And it's something that I would love to do as a politician, to be able to have more nuanced, detailed, longer, more complex conversations, fireside chats, so that we can understand the nuance of the world. I had a really great director tell me once, he goes, you know the difference between an adult and a child? An adult can hold two opposing ideas in their head at once. And that is what it means to be an adult. And we're getting into this place where we cannot have two opposing ideas in our head, but we need to be able to do it. It is a muscle. And if that muscle is not exercised, that muscle atrophies. And I'm starting to see that in our society, in which we're unable to recognize that two things can exist at the same time.
And I also think what you're seeing is a kind of an addition of virtue to culture that for me is dangerous and weird. It feels like internet fandom and the notion of knowing about every single solitary thing about the private lives and the political beliefs and the oddities of celebrities is putting us in this world where people are expected to represent perfection And the work that they make is also expected to represent some idea of perfection, you know? And so you have this kind of constant cycle of people doing or saying what the internet mob decides is the wrong thing to do or say, and their facade crumbling, right? Whether it's Kanye or it's the banjo player from Mumford & Sons or whoever the hell it is, there's this endless kind of hysterical cycle that we're on of realizing that the people we idolize are not as big and as good and as perfect as we thought they were. You know, the whole Harry and Meghan thing this week is such a strange thing to watch because so much of it is being influenced by a fictional television program, right? Like, it's all happening in the context of the biggest show on TV being The Crown. And The Crown is a recreation of the lives of the very people that still are alive in real life, but we're predicating our understanding of what's going on within that family based on something that some guy wrote that's now been played by actors. And so when we think of the queen, do we think of the woman who's playing the queen or do we think of the actual queen, you know? And who are Harry and Meghan inside of that? Are Harry and Meghan characters in The Crown now? Like, I genuinely think there are people out there who think that they actually are, who wouldn't be able to tell you the difference between those two people. And I'm concerned that that leaves us in this place of always marrying how we want the world to be with the culture and the art that we decide is worthy of being consumed. And for me, that's dangerous because art is not religion. Art is not dogma. Art is not orthodoxy. Art is stories and songs and movement and pictures that tell stories about who we are. It doesn't sit in a moral place. And so I don't know, because I don't know where to go with it, because I don't want my kid or anyone else's kids blindly taking in stereotypes anymore that hurt people, that denigrate people, that have meant something terrible to people in their past, that have been responsible for people's suffering. I don't want that. I also don't want to just vanish it, because it's still here. It still exists all around us. People are still racist and people still stereotype each other. Attacks
and
on Asians.
And this is a way to show why, like why we are where
is,
we are.
This is a way to show why. I don't know. The erasure, it troubles me.
Soft Revolution is supported by Effin' Birds, a book and free webcomic by Aaron Reynolds. For free daily comics, follow Effin' Birds on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or any of the other social media platforms you use to poison your mind. That's EFFIN birds, because these birds are offensive. Featuring lovely drawings of birds along with profanity-ridden inspirational sayings, perfect for 2021. I love this one with a gull thinking, "All this shit is breaking my mind." Follow Effin' Birds on social for their free daily webcomic.
Let's move on because we want to get a chance to let the tape roll on Dara. But I think there's one more thing that I would love to talk about with you, and it's this. It's a little Toronto-centric, but I think it's going to go to the heart of pretty much everywhere coming up pretty quickly. Toronto has banned outdoor gatherings until July 1st. That interests me, given
Clarify. They're not saying all outdoor. They're saying you cannot get a permit. You can't get a permit to do, like, an event. Yeah.
Pardon me. That's
You're
correct.
Allowed to go outside.
That's what I meant. From the perspective of, you can't have 100 people at a classical music concert in Hyde Park. You can't have a pride parade. You can't do these things. So they have basically sworn off the idea that life will be back to normal this summer. I feel like it's, again, a risky gamble on John Tory, the mayor of Toronto's part. Because if life is remarkably normal in June, and you do get into July and August without this ability to have people in crowds, at least controlled by security and by city rules, etc., do you not leave a summer of kind of like hyper exuberant, you know, chaos? Where people are going to be gathering in large groups anyway?
It won't be large groups. So yesterday, so last night, just to go back to Biden, the one thing he said, he goes, look, I'm going to be, first of all, I love this guy. This guy, you know, everyone said, don't elect the old guy. But you could just tell inside this guy that he's acting like a kid with he's got nothing to lose. A young 20-something feels like they have their whole life ahead of them, so whatever happens, whatever. But you could tell Joe Biden's like, I don't got much time, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to do whatever the hell I want. So Biden's like, look, I'm going to be honest with you guys right now. I'm going to be truthful with you guys. The game plan here, which I really love, it was a very tangible measurement of what vaccination can do. So starting May 1st, anyone, ultimately, he's directed, any adult who wants a vaccine can get a vaccine. And he said what that means is that on July 4th, on Independence Day, what a day, on Independence Day, you will be able to get in your backyard with your friends and family, and it's going to be okay. He goes, does it mean we're going to have thousands of people and whatever? No, but you're going to be able to get with your family and get in a backyard and have a barbecue, and it's going to be okay. So if John Tory is saying that come July, no, whatever, we're not going to have pride, we're not going to have whatever, that is, I'm okay with that. Because to me right now, I am literally walking the street and I am thinking about, I cannot wait for the day that I can order a pint of beer. And I can't wait to feel that froth on my lips. And it's, I'm telling you. So for me, the notion of being able to get in my parents' backyard with 10, 15 people and be able to like a bunch of Persians to get lit again, that is something that I go, wow, that is equivalent
Can I be an honor? Can I be the token white guy, please? I really want to.
Yeah, we always have a casting call, and but this time, you know what? Offer only. Offer only to you.
You're trying to diversify the backyard a little bit. Get some white people in there. That's very kind. I like that. That's real vision.
No, my brother-in-law, he shows up, so it's all good.
No, it's amazing. Let's get to Dara, but I think that's a good place to end because that is something too, Allie. Even I, Debbie Downer Torque, I've got to confess to you, brother, that over the last week or two, watching people get vaccinated, thinking about my mom soon getting vaccinated, thinking about all the reunions and all the little ways in which people have stayed patient, you know, stayed kind to each other, tried to hang in there, and it's going to be so beautiful. And these vaccines, as you keep on saying, are fucking miraculous.
A miracle.
And it is a beautiful time. There's lots of suffering. There's a long road ahead. It's dark and it's hard. But this is the thing about the news cycle these days and the fear clickbait and all that stuff. It's got to go. Now we've got to start thinking about how beautiful it is that we made it through this and how we're going to use what we've learned to make a more beautiful society into the future and not just be like, okay, you know, now I can go back to Walmart and not wear a mask anymore. That's not what it's about.
No.
It's about removing that mask so that you can see each other's faces again, how you've changed, how you've aged, what you've learned, and then been able to go in for a hug and be like, okay, let's do this together. We're both different. We've both changed. Shit's been hard. Let's go do something new. Speaking of something new, this film, Anne at 13,000 Feet, starring my beautiful niece, Dara Campbell, is truly extraordinary, you guys. If you haven't seen it yet, you really, really have to. It's not like anything you have watched before. I'm going to give you that as a caveat.
How can people watch it?
You can go onto the Toronto International Film Festival website and rent it there. It's streaming there exclusively right now. I would think that we'll ask Dara, but I think pretty soon it'll be up on Apple and all the major streaming sites. And it's had so much hype and so much buzz and so many great reviews. I doubt that it'll be long before you'll be seeing it on, I don't know, Criterion or Netflix or somewhere like that.
Love it.
And, you know, I think they're still hoping for a theatrical release. We're going to talk to Dara about this, but one of the crazy aspects of this is this film was supposed to come out almost this week. Last year.
Wow.
Yeah. And Dara was preparing to travel the world and go to premieres and do all kinds of things. And then bam. So it's
Lord
been
mercy.
Tough on young artists. Yeah. So let's hear from Dara about what that's been like on Soft Revolution. Dara Campbell, you're my niece. What's that like?
It's always been really fun.
So I watched your movie, Dee, and it's so fucking crazy. Like, it's such a crazy experience to watch it for anybody, I think, because it has, I've never seen a film like it. It was crazy for me in particular because you are my niece and, you know, I've loved you all your life. And it's always strange to see people you love acting, which I know you're very experienced in doing, because if they're good at it, then they convince you that they're going through the thing that the character is going through, and you begin to worry about them as a person instead of as the character. So, you know, this film is about a young woman who is going through a moment of disconnection from what everybody else needs her to be in the world, and kind of falling into a world of inside herself. And that was hard for me to watch you so convincingly go through that. It was also hard to watch you jump out of fucking airplane, which is just a crazy thing to do. I don't understand why your father allowed you to do that. I know you're 30, but he could have done something. He could have stepped in some way. But it's also a strange film because it seems to happen by accident. And I know that when I wrote to you about how much I had loved it and how much it had moved me and how strange it was, you talked to me a little bit about the idea that a lot of the time when you were making the film, you didn't quite know what was happening. Can you talk a little bit what you mean by that?
Yeah, with the character of Anne, I did, the preparation that you might expect. I, read some memoirs about people that have experienced mental health crises. But I think what became really exciting about Anne was completely deciding who she was, but instead, I had different ideas of who she was at different times, but when I finally started taking more pleasure in the performance and being more open, I think, was when I realized that I didn't completely know who she was, but just had this like one driving impulse which guided me, which was the idea that she desperately wants to be close to other people. But that she doesn't know how, but she's kind of hyper aware of when she makes other people uncomfortable, she can sense it. But what she does is she then tries harder and gets kind of more desperate and more aggressive. And to me, that's just tragic. Like seeing this person who just wants to be close to people, driving them further and further away, and becoming less and less in control of her life. The thing, so when I did finally see the movie, it's like I got to see who the character was for the first time. And I have the editor, Isla, as well as Kazik, who's in the edit, to thank for that.
It's about someone who wants intimacy and wants to connect with people. And I found it an incredibly Torontonian movie in some ways, because it examines very piercingly the kind of cult of moderation in Canadian culture, and how if you are a person that tends to go too far, people get very upset by that and sort of quietly offended. And there's a lot of moments in the film where you are operating on a plane that seems to you to be fine. Like people should know you're joking, or people should know that you're just, trying to connect. But instead, they take your actions in a completely other way. And so a lot of that's the uneasiness of watching the film, is that you are constantly in this place of, oh God, have I done or said the wrong thing? And as a viewer, you're constantly in that state of unease about whether she's about to fuck it up. We wanted to talk to you about the fact that you don't have any social media presence to speak of.
Yeah, that's my biggest question. Amazing.
But a lot of this movie, I think, even though it doesn't deal with the internet at all, I took it in many ways as a comment on the internet world. That we think that people of your generation and younger have a hard time distinguishing their sense of themselves from other people's sense of them, because they have this constant online humanity that they have to keep alive. Is that something that you were thinking about while you were making this at all? And why don't you, Dara, just man up and enslave yourself to the corporate social media system like the rest of us? You think you're better than me? Is that what it is?
I mean, first of all, I do have a fairly active Instagram account. I don't have Twitter.
Okay, that's good. Good, good.
Well, I have a flip phone, so I wouldn't know one way or the other. But
it is the hilarious dilemma of contemporary cinema of, like, how do we represent social media on screen when it is, like, so much of how we communicate with other people? Mm-hmm. And the answer is that, like, screens look terrible in films.
It's not a cinematic idea, is it?
So what ends up happening in a lot of films is they actually take that element out of life, which ends up giving the films this, like, strange quality of not being able to be placed in time. It's like everything happens in, you know, 2004 or something.
Right.
I'm not sure if it's something necessarily that we were thinking about for the film, but it is something that I think about in terms of performance. Because me as a person, I've always had a really, really hard time understanding how I'm perceived by other people. Like, since I was really young, like, when people would compliment me or insult me, like it would confuse me so much in trying to bring that information into my understanding of myself. So for the most part, I really, really, really try to not think about it, like, as much as possible, because it really does just confuse me. Like, people will be like, "You're pretty." And I'll be like, "Yeah, but, like, where on the spectrum of pretty?" Like,
out of 10, so, what am I getting with decimal points?
I basically would like to be subject to rating just for, like, total pretty.
Rotten Tomatoes, but for your entire life. That's what you'd like.
Yeah. Like, how intelligent am I? Like, could I get in to Harvard, or could I be, like, entertaining on a late night talk show? Like, I don't know. You know,
but that's a terrible thing. I mean, that is, you know, and I think you're not alone. I think so many people feel that way now. And what I admired about the film was the bravery it had in not trying to save your character. Do you know what I mean? That she was out there in the world and you were going to watch her fall. And there was nothing you as a viewer could do about it. The world wasn't going to change and somebody wasn't going to wake up and suddenly see that your character was trying to connect, that she was trying to be sane. She was trying to hold on. And I think that there's so much in the world that we live in where people do feel like they have nothing. They have no safety net. They are out on so many ledges. They're out on the ledge of the internet. They're out on the ledge of economic insecurity and, you know, late stage capitalism and all these things. And I felt all that dis-ease in the film beautifully. It's a very it's very special, Dara. It's a very special piece of work. It's made in a really weird way, and I'd love you to talk about this a little bit. You know, they come up with a cute name for it, which is, like, I don't know, micro filmmaking or micro budget or mumblecore or whatever the fuck you want to call it. But essentially, you and this crew of artists made this film over quite a long period of time, literally with the money that was being scraped together as you went along, correct?
That is true. Yeah. And I mean, that is how. So this is a film that was made with MDFF, which is a Toronto-based production company founded by Kashik Radvinsky, the director, and the producer, Daniel Montgomery. And they've been making movies this way for, you know, over a decade now. They've been working also, like, with Isla Editing and with Nikolai as a cinematographer for, like, the past, I think, three films. So it's this very close group. And then I also have, like, you know, my extended community, like Sofia Bogdanovich and Antoine Bourges, who I work with a bunch, who also work in that way. And what we mean when we say micro budget, because sort of by funding body standards, a low budget film is $1 million.
Right.
So
right.
A micro budget film, like all of these movies that I've made with my friends have been I think Anne was the biggest budget, and that's under 300,000. And like Sophia and I made Emma Slavik 7 for $25,000. That's including post-production.
That's your film that you co-directed and wrote, right? And went to the Venice Film Festival. I mean, it did incredible things.
So with micro-budget filmmaking, I think one of the most defining qualities about it is that, I mean, is not a new concept. It's something, you know, that you can see in like Rossellini's filmmaking or something. It's about creating a fiction, but basing it in a real life environment. You know, with Rome Open City, he's filming in the actual rubble of World War II, you know? And so in micro budget filmmaking, like rather than paying exorbitant amounts for locations and piles of extras, you know, you're just, you know, walking through Trinity Bellwoods Park, and like the amount of information that you get from that image about what Toronto is and who mm-hmm. lives in Toronto is so much richer. And it makes these films that are essentially hybrid documentary fictions.
Dara, where did you and your team learn this? And the reason I ask is because, so I teach, I'm a part-time professor at George Brown teaching Introduction to Acting. And what I do is I really try to encourage them. I say, look, we're going to do this project, but I want you guys to record it. I want you guys to learn how to edit it, because I am just very bullish on this type of filmmaking. Because especially as technology progresses, people are going to be able to do really, really incredible things. Where did you guys, was this out of necessity that your director fell into this? Or was it actually a belief that I could do something profound? And then the other thing is, how do and how can aspiring filmmakers or actors learn how to do it like this? Because I think people have this notion that, you know, the only way to make something is millions upon millions of dollars.
I didn't go to film school, but my friends did. Kaz and Dan went to Ryerson. And a lot of my friends actually have been doing the really quite amazing master's program at York. And that program, I understand too, has like quite a lot of access to funding and also equipment. So you really can like live as a filmmaker for 2 years. Which is really excellent. Like Sofia Bogdanovich has done that. Anton Borges has done it. Matt Johnson, Nico Pareda, but like a whole bunch of really amazing filmmakers have done it. I think it's interesting that it did stem from money. Like we're talking about Arts Council budgets. Like these films are made from like pooling Canada Council, Ontario Arts Council, and Toronto Arts Council together to kind of make up a budget. And then you can also from there, like apply for some post-production budget. The thing that is, you know, a bit interesting about how it works as an actor is, I've had to stay out of the union to work on these films.
Whoa. You know?
Right.
That is, I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, this is a really interesting thing.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah, because what Dara and her crew are doing, to me, I mean, you're still applying for government grants, but this is something I wanted you to talk about, is you really are fundamentally outside the system by which most films are made by choice. And that does mean foregoing money, right? I mean, it's not just that you can't get money, it's that you're deliberately choosing not to align yourself to money in making these films, because it hangs you up. It means that you have to work in certain hours, under certain conditions, with insurance, et cetera, correct?
Yeah. And what is so interesting too is like, because we did a talk about low budget filmmaking at TIFF, myself and Andrew Civadino and Matt Johnson a couple of years ago. And one of the questions from the audience that like quite I was embarrassed, it quite stumped me, but I've thought about it since, is this young actress put her hand up and was like, so if I'm going to be in non-union movies, like how can I protect myself? And I was like, well, and the answer is that like is community, you know, and like I'm not making movies with random people I find on the internet. The people that I'm making movies with are people I met in a literal physical cinema. They're people who I am in the audience with, you know, in normal times, 2 or 3 days a week. And so there is a trust and there is a mutual responsibility. If I obviously I'm open to working with people outside of my community, but then you have to do the amount of research that you do for anything these days, where I look up the people on the internet and I see who our mutual friends are and I ask people what their experience of working with them is. Because I mean, now, especially like with COVID and shooting in COVID, where smaller productions cannot afford to meet the COVID protocols, so they just can't shoot. It's like, would I work on a film right now, not with my friends, without COVID protocols in place? Like, absolutely not.
yeah, know? Good point.
This is such a huge thing, though, because I think it's, you know, you and I have grown up in a family who have many members of it who have spent their lives essentially in an employee position, but without any of the security of an employee. In other words, members of Equity or Actor or SAG or whatever it is, working on contract with theaters or film companies or television production companies and living by those rules, but never having their own band. And what you guys have done that I think is so amazing, and what so many people are now doing, as Ali said, now that the technology is allowing it, is that instead of the actor, the film actor, or the film screenwriter thinking of themselves as a free agent who goes out and tries to hustle work, you find your band, you form that band around mutual trust, around friendship, around a shared aesthetic, a shared style of working, and shared limitations about what you feel safe and unsafe doing. And then you proceed that way. And I just think it's a really, it opens a door for a lot of young people who are coming into the film industry who are being taught and being told that the only way to live in that industry is as a kind of, you know, a top down, hat out, begging for change, begging for a job mentality. And it's not true, right? It doesn't offer much of a future.
I think it's funny because I mean, and maybe you feel similarly about music, Torque, but I kind of always thought of, you know, pursuing film as this like independent pursuit, because I mean,
it was independent from the theater, which is what you were expected to do. Right. Yeah.
Or just that, like, you know, my parents and I mean our whole family are so involved in theater, and funnily enough, I didn't really watch that many movies growing up. I mean, I watched the movies that everyone watched. But I didn't really become like, I didn't start watching movies in like a cinephilic way until like 10 years ago, I think. And so I thought of it as this kind of independent thing. And I've looked at my life now and I realize that I've kind of like completely replicated the conditions of my parents' lives.
Yes.
And what I have replicated, what I really learned from my parents and from you is that success has to be shared, you know, like when our movie gets attention that, you know, is shared within a community and all of those people are lifted up by it. And we have something that is so much more sustainable, by moving up all of us together, than like a success that belongs to you and your management, you know. It's,
but having said that, I mean, I assume you want a life as a creator. Everybody, you know, most of the people who listen to this podcast are creators or people who love creators. Do you expect to make a living in film? Are you looking at the way that you and your friends are making movies right now and thinking, this can be a way for us to make a living? Or are you willing to work at another job in order to make films this way?
I'm about to turn 32. I can't even believe that.
That's just ridiculous. you're not. You're six. I have checked. You're 6 years old.
I would like to make a living. I certainly would. What I really appreciate though about the way that Sophia and Kaz are growing is rather than this very unnatural kind of thing of like, oh, you made a movie for $20,000 and it got into Berlin. Now you should pursue getting $5 million and waiting for 7 years to make your next film. Instead, they've grown the budgets like very gradually, but also they've grown the scope of ambition of the projects gradually, you know, where some of the ideas that we're having now are slightly more expensive ideas, you know, slightly more epic storylines. And to me, that's a much healthier relationship with art and money, you know, than just looking for a larger budget to participate, to kind of hold more power in an industry, you know?
You've had a lot of success from this film. You've been put on various magazine covers and all kinds of things that's made us all terribly proud. And and yet, as you said, you haven't joined the union. You're not, you know, you haven't moved to LA for pilot season. You haven't done the things that I'm sure various people have told you you should now do in order to advance your own career. This film was about to come out almost a year ago this week, I think, correct? Like just right around this time anyway. I remember being on the phone with my mom or with somebody and her saying, Dara's film's about to come out. It's a huge deal. She's getting ready to travel all over the world and go to openings. And things were really, really happening very quickly for this movie. And then the shit hit the fan. And everything stopped. What's this year been like for you in terms of where it leaves you moving forward? Because you were at this moment of flux, this moment of explosion in your life, and then everything came to a stop. Looking back, are you glad that happened? Or is it like, damn, that was a missed opportunity?
I am not glad the world stopped, Torquil. It has nothing to do with me.
Well, you know what, Tara? A lot of people are. That's the thing. A lot of people are glad the world stopped. I myself, not one of them, but no. I think a lot of people felt relief that they no longer had to be responsible for what happened next in their lives, you know? But it must have been a crushing moment. So where does it change the way you see the future for yourself as a filmmaker, I guess, is what I'm asking.
What has happened with Anne, I think, has been very unique in that, like, actually the critical establishment in Toronto specifically has really kept the film afloat. Like, they really continued talking about it. They, like, have anticipated when it will be released. Like, they, you know, talked about it in year-end roundups and everything like that. So we did have this year between, you know, it playing at the festivals and its theatrical release. But it kind of became like a bit of a running joke, like, when will we get to see Anne at 13,000 feet? And that kind of, you know, kept it alive. And now we, you know, we got distribution from an amazing distributor in the United States, Cinema Guild, that just distributes some of my favorite international films. And so Fantastic. They're actually waiting for cinemas to be open.
Fantastic. I was going to ask you about that, whether that was going to happen or not. I'm really glad to hear that.
I miss cinemas. And I also, really miss film festivals. Film festivals have become extremely important to me. Like, my entire career has been built on film festivals because it's, you know, where, I mean, sure, they're markets for selling films, but they also are really one of the places where you see what, it's a meeting where you find out where what is being made internationally. And you watch films in a completely different way where you become very open to just watching what the movie is doing and what decisions have been made, and the amount that you can just, there can be different routes to you becoming moved by something, just makes most movies seem like painting by numbers, you know?
What's next? What are you going to do? Are you guys going to make another film as a group together? Is there a way through? Are you going to make your big COVID movie? Like, as a creator, what's happening next for off the back of the success of this film for you?
Yeah, people are figuring it out. I know some stories from the summer of people that in really small productions have bubbled together and made stuff. We do have funding for another film from with Kaz, where we will be able to, you know, get the testing necessary to shoot with a small crew and small cast once again. And then one of the really exciting things is that I've been writing a film with my frequent collaborator and beloved friend Sofia Bogdanovich. Yeah, which has been really great. And so we're just kind of in the process of, she's sort of moving into structuring the funding and everything for that. But I don't involve myself in that aspect because
that is so much of the work, right? Is having the strength of character and the organizational skills and the ability to do those grant applications is like, I love and respect anyone who can manage it, but
it's why people who can, it's why people who do this kind of stuff can really do anything.
Yeah.
Anything.
Yeah. We should get them some vaccines out there, actually. We should keep them in charge of that shit. Listen, Dee, I think the movie's incredible, and I think it's cool that you brought up our family and your parents, because I know that my dad, who you loved a lot, would think that the way you are doing things is the way of revolutionaries. And, you know, that was what mattered to him, was that people do things as revolutionaries. And it is revolutionary, and it feels revolutionary. It's beautifully edited. Oh my God, the editing is so great in this film. And it's beautifully technically shot. And it has incredible integrity as a narrative and as a piece of film. It's in many ways classically beautiful as a film, but also kind of unlike watching a film. It's very strange and very extraordinary experience. And it fills me with pride that you're so brilliant and so unsettling in it. And thank you for talking about it. And you guys, everybody out there should go find this film and start thinking, you know, we're all going to come out of this, right? And I guess this is my last question to you, Dara, is this is starting to end. In what are you going to do differently that you didn't do before because of this year?
I don't like the way that in COVID kind of everything has become conditional. Like you make a decision, but that isn't necessarily, you have to be completely open to that not coming to pass.
True. Right.
Which, you know, is a challenge to an anxious person, but I hope moving forward that I'll be a little bit more comfortable with not knowing exactly what's going to happen and not feeling that I have to think through every future possibility, but kind of take things day by day as they come. And I think there's more pleasure in that, meeting things as they come to you.
My niece, the best niece there is, Dara Campbell on the Soft Revolution podcast. Thank you, Dee. I love you.
Is she your only niece?
No, she's not. I'm just putting it out. That's it. I don't care. I'm offending all my other nieces. They don't listen to this, Allie. They don't care what I say. I have many nieces. They're all wonderful. Dara is among them. She's just right now, because she made that great movie, she's kind of edging everybody else out.
I understand.
You want to be my favorite niece? Make a movie as good as Anne at 13,000 feet. It's not rocket surgery. You know what to do. Fascinating, right? Fascinating,
yeah,
how she's making films. And that's, I mean, I could have talked all day about that. I feel like we were constrained by time in some ways, because that is, to me, at the heart of how we all get out of this better off, even though we're all so much worse off right now. And the industry is so collapsed, except for film and TV. But that's so top down. And, you know, sure, you roll the dice, or you buy your lottery ticket when you audition for one of those things, or you try to get involved in those things. But the chances are slim. How do you take back some control? How do you self-determine in this job as an artist? You do it in a circle of trust with people you love, with friends. You create a band, whether it's a theater or a film or whatever it is. Get your crew together. I think that is, like, to me, a huge takeaway from that interview. So,
well, I was showing videos of Dustin Hoffman inside the Actors Studio with my students at George Brown yesterday, and he was going on about the Actors Studio. It was like, and he was talking about, there's this place that you can go.
You could
and
go.
It was free. And it was with the best actors, and you would just get together, and we would just be doing stuff, and we were trying things. And it was like, and I'm like, do we have something like that here?
No, we don't.
No, we've lost that that kind of spirit, and it'd be nice to kind of get it back.
Well, and there's a big conversation about, you know, when you're a performing artist, you move between worlds, between micro-budget independent films made with your friends and a Hallmark film. And in between, there is a vast, you know, panoply of different experiences, different budgets, and all those things mean different levels of protection for the worker and different obligations for the production company. And I think that a lot of it has gotten very confusing, and there needs to start to be some clarity around, how do we get artists to be more independent and more entrepreneurial and self-creating in their work? Because it makes it easier for everyone. It makes a healthier industry. So anyway, go see Anne at 13,000 feet, or rent it, or do whatever you have to do. It's a really, really cool film. You won't regret it.
Love it.
Okay. That's Soft Revolution for another week. Ali, before we go, can we get a quick update on the campaign, bro? How's it going?
Campaign is amazing. Listen, if you live in Toronto, St. Paul's, if you know anybody who lives in Toronto, St. Paul's, I want you to let
them
know.
You know somebody.
You do.
Like a million people.
So what is Toronto, St. Paul's? Yonge and Eglinton, Davisville, Summer Hill, Rose Hill, Little Jamaica, St. Clair West, Yonge and St. Clair.
You know what you're carving out right there, Ali?
What?
That's my teenage territory right there. That
I
was
want you
my
to call
Toronto.
Everybody whom you remember.
When I was a teenager, that was my Toronto. Oakwood Collegiate up on St. Clair, down
call
to the Lakeshore.
Friends, Tor,
that's
why
where
aren't
I
you
rolled.
Doing this for me? Why aren't
unfortunately,
you calling up
none
your
of them are speaking to me anymore. But
That's understandable. I didn't expect anything else. So that's all good. Anyways,
yeah,
no,
you don't
campaign's
wanna...
going well. Campaign's going well. You know, anyways, alimoman.ca if you wanna do that. It's going well. I want to say also one thing, you know, so we did do the Patreon thing, and now, you know, a third of our what we get from Patreon is going to the AFC, which is amazing. Also, I want to commend some of our Patreon members who, upon hearing this news, have upped their contribution.
To those people,
how big is your heart? And unbelievable that it fits in your chest. So,
love
that.
AFC, by the way, folks, if you're out there and you're struggling financially, but you're not an actor, it used to be known as the Actors Fund of Canada. It's now known as the AFC because they are open to requests from anybody in the creative industries. Whether you're a makeup artist, whether you worked on a crew, whether you're a director, a writer, a singer, get in touch with them. They're an amazing organization. I have deep, close friends and family who've worked for them. They have incredible integrity, and they're there for you. There's no need to feel shame around it. There's no need to feel anything. They want to help. They know what it's like. You will find a loving, compassionate ear. No, man. If you're still alive and you're still calling yourself an artist right now, you're a hero. Okay? So if you need help, don't hesitate to ask for it. These people are there. It's confidential. It's loving. It's safe. And they will just get you some money so you can pay that rent and get your act together for the next month. You know, it's a beautiful organization. We're proud to be associated with them. So go check out the AFC and please join our Patreon. By doing so, you will continue to build the fund that the AFC have to give out to creators all over this country. That's Soft Revolution for another week. Ali, what's your art pick, babe?
Well, I am going, you know, the album is not fully out, but John Batiste has some incredible, incredible music out. There's a
John
song
Batiste,
called
John Batiste, the band leader on Stephen Colbert's late night show, correct?
This I did not know.
Yes.
This I did not know.
A charming
really
television personality.
Colbert. Can I tell you, and this is a late night situation. Now it's like, it seems like late night is really like, here's the YouTube clip that you need to watch.
Yeah.
So I really, with the exception of knowing, you know, the roots on Jimmy Fallon, I don't really know the musicians anymore. So, you know, why don't, hey, this is a little thing to Colbert. Instead of just your monologue that you share or the interview clip that you share, share some music.
Share some Colbert. John Batiste. He's a beautiful musician and a lovely man. And he's got a new record out. I, too, am going to choose music. And we're going to play this one because she doesn't make as much money as John Batiste.
Yeah, John Batiste is rich, so it's all good.
My art pick this week is a new single called Anything Can't Happen by a singer-songwriter named Dorothea Pass. Dorothea is from Toronto and is a part of an amazing community of new musicians there that's made up of a bunch of really cool bands like the Bad J Pac Ensemble and US Girls and all kinds of really cool, Bernice, beautiful band, Bernice, go check out Bernice. But Dorothea has worked inside a lot of these bands for years and also happens to be in Anne at 13,000 Feet, playing the role of Dara Campbell's Anne in the film, Anne's best friend. She also happens to be one of Dara's best friends. So you see how art and life are imitating one another in a beautiful way. But this single is gorgeous. Dorothea is a really original songwriter with a really original voice. It's very sophisticated. It's very haunting. And it comes from a world of people who have serious chops. All these people are players, man. And you can hear the quality of the musicianship in the work. So look out for her album that's coming out soon. And here's her single, Anything Can't Happen by Dorothea Pass. That's Soft Revolution for another week. We'll see you next time. We love you. Stay safe.
Love you. Bye-bye.